the humble frog is really responsible for a lot of starting off science. It's the frog that started a lot of science. Now, a lot of people will know the story of Galvani, an Italian medical physicist who became fascinated about living electricity. That is, if you actually hooked up a frog, you could actually reanimate it, or if you chopped it up, got its legs, and you could reanimate those legs. And it was done, I suppose, by actually pinning up the legs with wires. And like Frankenstein, and actually related to Frankenstein, he was in Italy, and when there was a big electricity storm, there was voltages got on all things electrical, and the actual frog legs twitched or came to life with electricity. Then a little while later, he was running out of different wires to hook it up, so he used different metals to hook up his frog legs, and amazingly his frog legs twitched when he added two different metals. And adding two different metals to a frog leg is actually making a small little battery. So the frogs, in this case, gave birth to our interest in electricity. Volta followed down the path of the different metals to look at electricity, and so eventually developed our more chemical-based idea of electricity rather than a biological or life force of electricity. So the frog, unfortunately dismembered, actually prompted us to understand more about electricity. And I'll come back to electrons. I'm going to do a podcast trying to get into magnetism. And magnetism, look, I can say, look, I do understand certain parts of it. Parts of it are actually beyond my ability to imagine and fully understand. So I'll come up front and talk to you about that. But that, of course, doesn't stop me actually talking through the bits I do understand. Getting back to our frog, I think another part about frogs, so frog was a very sort of personal frog. It stimulated the mind of one scientist. But frogs can actually stimulate the minds of many, many people, because the little humble frog is nice and small. It's also wet, so it's actually ideal for another experiment, physics experiment. And this is with the world's most powerful, powerful magnets. And strangely, we all think of magnets as attracting things, but magnets can actually repel things. So what happens is they said, oh, well, let's pop this little frog in this incredibly intense electromagnet. And electromagnets are circles of wires, and they have holes in the center, and the magnetic field goes through the center. And you'll see this little frog floating in a magnetic field. And I think this is where our stories part. School science tends to have a very rigid number of things they tell students, which gives them a nice set of examinable knowledge. School science also loves to grab high interest stimulating materials, like showing a frog floating in a magnetic field. But unfortunately, what you go on to explain to students doesn't actually explain why water, basically a little frog, will actually float in a strong magnetic field. It's actually not a strong magnetic field, it's a gradient, strong magnetic field gradient. So as the magnetic field is increasing, the frog will be pulled up. So it's not a magnetic effect as you think of something being north and south. You can't actually just flip the frog over and get a different polarity of the frog and it suddenly gets slammed through the magnetic field. There is something about the frog which is pushed away by magnetic fields. And this is also true for water. Water is another thing which is pushed. In fact, a majority of stuff on the periodic table is pushed away by water. It's called, pushed away by magnetic field. And this pushing away, or rejection, or not liking being in a strong magnetic field, is called diamagnetism. Something is diamagnetic. And there's something else, obviously, is water itself. So if you just have a test tube of water floating, you can actually push it around away very, very slowly with a strong magnet. It's hard to imagine that's diamagnetic. Obviously, something which I recognise very quickly is the most strongly repelled by strong magnetic fields materials that I think we do know of. Bismuth used to be up there, so bismuth used to be able to float up. They used to have the ability to carbon, pure carbon, so charcoal and that type of stuff, could... structure is very important, and this is interesting, the structure of the actual carbon is important, but you could actually make things levitate, thin bits of carbon, magnets levitate in magnetic fields, above carbon, because the carbon would push it away. Now, as you build better carbon, you can make it levitate more, and my actual new heart valve that they've put in my heart is coated with a special type of carbon called isotropic pyrolytic carbon. So this is specially meshed graphite layers, and you can get very small samples of this and actually float this in the class in front of people on top of magnets. Now, the real problem about showing students this is they're going to ask why, and we don't really have the good story to give them an answer. So you can go on the internet and see levitating pyrolytic carbon. I really recommend actually getting some of it, researching it, ordering it in, just have a little play around it. It's a fantastic material. In my heart valve, it's really strong and flexible. We can go into that a bit later. But it's also used in the back of electronics because it's got a thermal conductivity, which is fantastic along the surface. So it's like a paper carbon. And what happens is you can heat it at one point and the heat will not travel through, but along to the edges. So it's ideal for electronics where you want slim electronics and you want the heat to dissipate out to the edges very quickly. So coming back, we're talking about things which are repelled by magnetic fields. And essentially it goes back to trying to understand what is it doing, the repelling, and why. Now, I don't know how far I'm going to get in this particular podcast, but the most fundamental thing that is... we'll go into electrons and then we'll go into special relativity. Now, there's a very famous concept that you can actually fire a beam of electrons into a magnetic field by simple physics that you'll study later on in school. It will tend to bend and curve in that magnetic field. And so this is used in the old TV sets. I like to use magnetic fields because you could actually build the magnet outside the TV set, and the less things you have to put inside the TV set, the better. And so this is, you have an electron gun which generates a beam of electrons, and the beam of electrons is steered onto a phosphorus screen. I have to explain this because nowadays these I suppose the last time that our children have seen this is occasionally one of these will be thrown out in waste as people who have spent a lifetime saving up for a large one of these tubes says it's no longer any good, and they put it out on the side, and my children have a look at this and say, what's this, Dad? And this is a cathode ray tube. Cathode ray is the old term for electrons before they knew what they were rays coming from a cathode, and someone said, I know what these are electrons. So it's called cathode ray tube. And the idea is that this beam goes through this pair of magnets, vertical and horizontally deflecting magnets, and this paints the screen, much like a painter who drags a paintbrush of electrons across the phosphorus to make things glow. Fantastic technology. I think people will really appreciate this in years to come. Now, you can make one with magnets. You can also make it with electrodes. This is plates, electric plates, where the electric plates attract and deflect the electrons. Now, the use of electric plates are quite good is because a magnetic coil, it's like a spring, it's got a frequency, so you can build the coils just to do one or two frequencies. If you use plates, they're really great because they're very, I suppose, lightweight. They can do a lot of frequencies, sort of like a musical instrument, so they can be highly responsive. And this is important if you're looking at signals which are much higher frequency than the sweeping, the steady rhythmic sweeping across a screen. So to take an analogy, if you have if you want to generate a horn on a truck which only does one frequency, you can use fairly low cost parts and build everything up for that particular frequency. So you don't pay a lot of money, but when you need that horn to make the sound, you can just press a button, it goes. But if you want to do something with which generates many frequencies, you've got to be a bit more, use high finesse and actually use a speaker cone. They're slightly different. The horn, so the analogy here is that the horn is cheap, it's outside, only does one frequency. The plates do it a different way. They're more expensive and harder to use, but they do a much greater range of frequencies. Now, in terms of the frequency we can see, it's the deflection of the electron. Now, one of the beautiful ideas is that you can actually match the magnetic deflection of an electron beam with the electrical deflection of an electron beam absolutely perfectly, that the electron actually feels these fields, a bit of magnetic field, a bit of electrical field, and they're all lined up such that the electron actually doesn't move. It's sort of, I suppose, like having flaps on a wing of a plane, two sets of flaps on the top and bottom of a biplane, one which starts the plane going lift, the other one which gets it facing downwards. And if the electron was just purely a charge, this would produce a single beam. So one could say this would be a central spot on the TV screen. So rather than scanning, you could actually arrange it such that if it tried to go left with a magnetic field, it could get the same electric field and the beam would be exactly the same. And this was all very, very fine until someone, the Stern Galactic Experiment, looked at that beam very, very, very carefully, the final spot of the undeflected electron. So you can imagine a pea shooter firing at the same point and hitting the same point, and the pea shots would actually build up. But rather than build up in a single point, it built up in two points, one to the north pole and one to the south pole of the magnet, the deflecting magnet. Always that way. And no matter what you did, there was always these two little poles, two little deflections. So if you were shooting, the actual bullets would actually split into, say if you had, it was a garden hose, and you're hosing a flower with it, and you could actually arrange it such that the water went either side of the flower and in the strong magnetic field. And so the answer is that that stream of electrons, besides having each electron having a charge, each electron had a small magnet associated with it. And those magnets were special magnets. They weren't oriented in any which way. So if I just have a bag of magnets and I throw it on the ground, the north poles will go in every single direction. So similarly, if this throwing the electrons on the ground, we throw it in a magnet sorter to see which orientation those magnets are, and they either 50% of them all point exactly precisely to the north pole with no deviation whatsoever, and then the other 50% point precisely to the south pole. Now, this is an interesting situation because we exploit this factor, because you can actually get the poles to flip if you set it up in the right conditions, the electrons in the right conditions, and you can actually send a radio pulse through and actually get the poles of those electrons to flip. And this process of getting them to flip and flip backwards is what's used in an MRI, magnetic field resonance imaging. It used to be called NMRI, and the people said, we're going to send you in for an enema, and people said, I'm not having that. And what they were saying, look, we're just going to stick you, rather than stick something up your bottom, we're actually going to stick you in a big magnet. And so they changed it to magnetic resonance imaging. That's a story from the actual birth of the idea. That's one of those incredible things. I've been around to actually see something in the lab to actually something used to actually look at me. It's a pretty extreme case. I can't believe it's happened in my lifetime. So getting back, so your electron, if you had to actually tag an electron, it's got a charge which is fixed, and it's got an electric field which is up or down, and your material is magnetic purely because of the way that it holds onto these electrons. And so if it holds onto these electrons, which in such a way that all these little electrons are actually contributing to the, or put their north towards the south pole, that'll be attracted to the field. If it's the other way, it'll be away from the field. I'll be able to get into that perhaps in the next podcast. But one of the things is we have to get into what a magnetic field is. And there's also, I suppose, a bit of a beautiful story here. So the first thing, people probably didn't really question what a magnetic field was. I will have to really start off with the history of magnetic fields. This will take a few podcasts. Now, magnetic field, the word magnet is absolutely fantastic. And it really starts off with the, I suppose, discovery or the commercialization, the commoditization of iron. So this is obviously 600 Bronze Age. I'm just trying to work this out. Probably 600 BC, 600... Okay, right. So man started to actually work his way down the reactivity of the periodic table, starting with copper, which was easy to refine. So you add some copper ore and some carbon. You heat it up together. The carbon rips the oxygen away from the copper, and you get a whole lot of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide coming off, and a lump of copper at the end. You add the copper with tin and you get bronze, the start of the Bronze Age. So going into the after the Bronze Age, you have the Iron Age, and that's where they became a bit more sophisticated, went up a level, and actually got the carbon to rip the oxygen out of iron. So iron's a bit more reactive, actually holds its oxygen a bit more, so you have to be a bit cleverer, a bit more careful, but you do get iron. And obviously when you first get iron, you think, oh look, I'll make a few axes, I'll make a few spears, enough things to up, basically as soon as I get an invention, I use it to hurt someone else, unfortunately. But along with commercial ideas, people began to put iron nails in their shoes. You know, what do you think next? And this shepherd, and listen out for the name of this particular shepherd, in ancient Greece, had iron in the soles of his shoes, diamonds in the soles of his shoes, iron nails in his shoes. And he's walking along, and remember, they haven't invented chewing gum. Chewing gum comes from Lechakaspi, which is a gum in a South American tree, so the Greeks definitely didn't have chewing gums. But he was walking along, and he had the sensation that he stepped in some chewing gum. Obviously, we didn't know what happened, and he looked at it, and his shoe, he took off the shoe, and his shoe would stick to these rocks, and duck up the rock, and be able to lift the rock up, and see the shoe stick to it. And so he had discovered something which was called the lodestone, and it's a civilization. It occurred in other civilizations, but this particular Greek is a very important person. Obviously, he found something, evidently became quite rich, or his master who owned the slave, he found this out, became quite rich. And the name of the person we know today, because it's commemorated in the name of magnets and magnetism. It was Magnus. So he was a bloke called Magnus, discovered magnetism, and he began to sell parts of this hill. And this was so fantastic that this area of Greece was named after the person, and he was called Magnesium. So we discovered magnets in that way. And for a long time, I think in the ancient world, using the Aristotle theory that stones love being in the earth, and so that's why things fall, they're just trying to get to the earth. Smoke is like the clouds, so it's trying to get to heaven like the clouds are in heaven. This obviously would have been really easy to teach science back then. You just invent any idea and just browbeat people into it. And so the idea of magnets, well, I took them away from their home at Magnetic Mountain, and so a lot of people, I know it was hard to believe, actually believe their magnets would point back to Magnetic Mountain. And so this caused a lot of problems. Some people were able to use their magnets very well, actually getting the lodestone to float in a little straw boat on some water to use it as guidance. It wasn't until the Queen's physician, Dr. Gilbert, and when I say Queen, Elizabeth I in the Renaissance, began to actually do some experiments, that this person, who, it's fantastic to read, A, he was a brilliant person, and B, he was absolutely crucified by Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon is the sort of father of the scientific method, the AIM method, etc., that you study at school. But one of the things is that he had no time for this Dr. Gilbert, who in my book was quite famous. So Dr. Gilbert actually coined the word for electron. So he didn't actually discover electrons had charges, but he did actually discover that there was positive and negative charge. That had to wait to, Benjamin Franklin, who actually began to figure that point out. But going back, Gilbert said, look, there is something causing electric charge, and it's from rubbing together amber, and the word for amber in that term, the term for the Greek amber, is electra. And so he actually coined the term electricity, and then many years later, the sort of unit of electricity is an electron, talking about the on aspect to name it. So Gilbert worked this out, and then he began to sort of work his way through magnets, and has discovered that magnets have poles. You have the North Pole and the South Pole, and as you perhaps know, you've got two magnets, either attract, or the two Souths repel each other. Now this repelling and attraction is something to really, really think about. And we have developed a method of describing it, and I suppose a pretty crazy way of explaining it. It's quite amazing. So it's Dr. Gilbert, and my students always laugh at it, and I show the picture of it. So he fashioned the magnets into two balls, lodestones with two balls, and he was able to show that the big ball, the Earth. So this stage, people believe that, are supposed to believe that the Earth is flat. That's the overall story. But obviously this wasn't the case if you actually go back and read at the history. And he was able to point out that the orientation of a compass, or a fundamental little lodestone around this magnetized ball, this sphere of a lodestone, indicated that the actual Earth was a giant lodestone and that you have a North Pole and a magnetic mountain in Magnesia, discovered by Magnus, was no longer the great thing, and Britain could expand on its navies using compass, using magnets. I have to tell a little story about the British Empire and magnets. I'll probably finish off about them because I'm going over 25 minutes. So there's this picture of a famous painting of Dr. Gilbert showing his magnetic balls to Queen Elizabeth I, and people always have a bit of a giggle there. And it was only a time. So he discovered the North and South Pole, which is before we actually discovered negative and positive charges, which was Benjamin Franklin and his kite and their idea. People didn't fully understand that currents could flow in wires. It's actually quite interesting to see how this information flowed out. And now you will have to remember that the work of Ampere and Volta is actually after the American Revolution, and actually after the time of Benjamin Franklin. So Benjamin Franklin, a US person, was actually discovering things ahead, and that sort of fed into the understanding of this. So we've got these magnets, and the actual development of something that we know as magnetic field lines was developed by the scientist who happened to also be making etching plates, beautiful copper plates. And it's probably not surprising in that he used to make these religious copper plates showing the rays of goodness coming out of the hands of gods. He used the same sort of idea to draw these magnetic field lines. We'll try and finish up here. And so when they realized that this magnetic field lines and the magnetic field lines bending actually being physical things wasn't true, they developed electromagnetism, that is, fusing the idea of electric field and magnetic field together to form light. So if you like, you can actually bundle up a little bit of electric field and magnetic field in a little sort of box, so to speak, called a photon, and you can fire it out through space, and so you can sort of whip an electron in a magnetic field at one point, say on the sun, and that will bundle a little bit of free floating electric and magnetic field, which will travel through space, hopefully through the atmosphere, avoid a few clouds, and go straight into your eye, and that whipping of the electron whips an electron in your eye, which then goes through a process and produces the sensation of light, light in your head. It's when it came up, this sort of fusion of the electron and electricity and magnetism to get light, which is really the next generation after the field lines, which we teach in school. It was Einstein who actually developed the understanding that electricity and magnetism is the same force, but in different frames of reference. So what unfortunately happens, or fortunately, if I see an electric field in a spaceship travelling close to the speed of light, or the occupants generate an electric field, seeing it at the speed of light, I interpret that as a magnetic field, and it's a beautiful way to get between electric and magnetic field in there. But quantum mechanics, and going back to electrons, actually gets you sort of a magnetic field which is frame independent. So charge and the quantum magnetic moment, the magnetic field on electrons, are frame independent. So what happens is that if I have a charge and I put it on a spaceship, myself, sorry, the the charge's mass will increase as it approaches the speed of light, but the actual charge as I determine it will be the same. And true, this is true for the magnetic field associated with an electron. So out there, for every electron is spin up and spin down electrons. There's north facing north and south facing north. North fields all throughout the universe. So this is one of the things to try and get your mind about, is that electrons not only have a charge, and protons not only have a charge, but everything has a small magnetic field associated with it. And how you actually arrange your matter can mean that the matter has a net magnetic field, and the matter can exhibit their properties of how they respond in magnetic fields to how that matter is arranged, how the electrons, protons, and neutrons are organized. So magnetic fields, when you're introducing it, you have to stay really close to the Bible. The original Bible of magnetic fields are produced by mini magnets. Here's a magnet. Well, imagine smaller magnets, and each small magnet has a magnetic field line coming out of it. It's not a very it's a way of explaining things that only gets you so far, and there's a whole lot of science out there, and we really haven't explored the territory between advanced science and the basic science which we're teaching at school. But indeed, this advanced science, that's not really advanced science, is accessible if you take the time. So I hope this podcast is a step towards understanding that. In the meantime, I'll summarize before I sign off. I've talked about magnetic fields. I've talked about the history of magnetism, from Magnus right through Gilbert, through Faraday, who's the magnetic field line guy, through Maxwell, who worked out about light, and eventually through to Einstein, who worked out that magnetism, electricity, is the same beast, but in different frames of reference. We've talked about that. We've talked about the fact that you've got these fundamental magnets in our universe. That's your universe out there in podcast land, and these fundamental units are a bit more spooky in terms of they aren't like a compass which points any which way. They flip. They're either pointing directly to the north or directly to the south. Now, just before I stop, there are lots of diagrams of electrons slowly moving from north to south in MRI machines. And now there is a real trick to that. What they've done is they've created a precession, an effective magnetic field line, by actually lining up all the electrons and getting them to orbit in a particular way. So it really is an illusion that they can move smoothly between two points. But in reality, we live in this weird, weird quantum world. It's the world that you and I live in. And electrons and protons and neutrons can only move between north and south. So I hope I've stimulated a lot of interest. There's a lot for you to look up on the internet on here to actually move forward. And of course, this is outside the comfort zone of many people who believe that magnets are really simple stuff that they've learnt in school, where you just draw magnetic field lines. I'll get into explaining a bit more of that next episode. In the meantime, keep on doing science.